Okay, are we ready? Let's go ahead and start the governance committee. It'd be great to be able to go home by noon today. We do have, if I could have consent to approve the agenda without objection, it's approved. Could I have a motion to approve the minutes, please? Is there a second to approve the minutes?
Second.
Okay, it's moved in, moved by Mr. Costa, second by Mr. Nichols. All those in favor?
Aye.
Minutes are approved. Our task today is to continue working our way through the procedures. We did, I spent some time with staff. We think we have incorporated most of the areas that folks had, that we had talked through last time. So I don't want to spend a lot of time on that. I'd like to start with Section 4. I would also tell you that we did receive some input from the JCC on the issue of what they would like to see here. So we'll be bringing that forward to you at a later time. So we're on page 5 of the document, Agenda Development and Distribution. And I would point out that there's some language in here that's different than our current practice. So I want you all to be aware of that. Beginning in the second sentence, it says the final agenda will be made available to the public at the same time it is distributed to the board. Board members will get the other supporting materials, but the supporting materials will be posted on the WMATA website on Monday rather than our current practice, which is Friday. And the purpose of suggesting this to you all is that it would give board members time to look at those materials prior to the public having access to them. It still would give the public, you know, Monday night, Tuesday, Wednesday, till our Thursday meeting. So I just wanted to draw that to your attention. The other thing that I think has been an understanding but is stated more clearly here than perhaps it has been in the past is that the very last sentence, which says changes proposed after the Friday distribution will be shared to the extent possible with board members and the public in advance of the board meeting. So, again, we shouldn't have too many blue items that we've not had some prior notice that they're coming. So those are the issues that are here. Mr. Dowd.
Question with respect to that, and I think the staged release is a good idea. Give us a chance to digest this stuff, but also give time for discussion. When we say that changes proposed after the Friday distribution and subsequent changes to documentation will be highlighted, that includes both the agenda item and the supporting material, correct?
Yes.
Yeah, because that's being distributed to us on Friday.
Right.
Okay.
Anybody have any issues with moving this forward, at least as in our draft? Mr. McKay.
I just have a question, logistical question of staff, because the challenge that I have personally is the volume of material coming in to my office and trying to keep track of it, and it seems like we are overwhelmed with late materials always before meetings, and I'm just wondering, will this change likely increase the need and frequency to do that, or is there going to be a structural change within the staff that is going to reduce the volume of that occurring? And that may be an unfair question, but before we adopt this, you know, I don't want to exacerbate an already difficult logistical problem by moving up the date that we get materials. Does that mean more things are going to come in late and we're going to be getting inundated with things the day or two before the meeting?
This doesn't actually change when we get it.
There's not a change in when the board will receive the materials, and I don't think there's a change in the language concerning highlighting any changes that may occur after you initially receive the materials and when the board ultimately takes the matter up. The only change is when those materials would be posted to the public. So instead of being simultaneous with the posting to the board, it would be delayed until Monday.
COP. Well, I guess that kind of relates to the second part of my question, which is, you know, I would rather have the date closer to the meeting if I knew we were getting all the materials at one time. What I don't like is 10 materials coming in after I've already read the package before the board meeting, and then I got to start over and try to print these out, read them, track them down, get them in a package that I bring to the board meeting. And so I guess my question is are we going to do a better job of making sure what goes out Friday? Because for the public, you know, I'm only imagining what's going to happen to them. I mean, are they going to have to go back every day after Friday and check to see if updates or new materials have come out? I mean, you know, because they're going to be looking at materials then that are dated, and they're not going to know. They got to go back every day between Friday and Thursday to make sure updates aren't sent out. And that could be, that's frustrating for us. I can only imagine how frustrating that's going to be for the public. So if we're going to get them materials earlier, I think we need to do a much better job of making sure those materials are complete and minimizing the need for staff changes between Friday and Thursday. I think that heightens the need to do that.
Just to be sure, again, this doesn't change when the board will receive the materials.
I'm aware of that. I'm aware
of
that.
So I understand your concern about changes, and I'm sure everyone will pay attention to that, the various folks who staff the committees and so forth. But what's being proposed here doesn't change it. I understand what you're saying is you'd like staff to change its practices.
Right, and I think if we're going to change our practice and make this available to the public on Friday before, we need to do a much better internal job to make sure what's going out Friday is pretty much what's going to be going to the board Thursday, and there is not this opportunity to change 10 or 15 things before the meeting. We have to show discipline on the staff side with that, that if you're giving the public, the only thing worse than the public getting advanced information is finding out the day of the meeting that all that information they got is different now than what's before them. So I think we need to do a much better job of that, consistent with this change in this.
I don't think, as I read it, there is a change from our perspective.
We would be
receiving the material on the Friday,
right,
or by mail on Saturday or whenever. I think what also has not changed is our expectation that that is the full, finished, complete, not to be amended package, except in very unforeseen circumstances.
I think that's the part you're
saying. That's the part I'm concerned about, because I have seen us drift away from that. Right.
Right. And I do think governance has contributed to the feeling of dribble. So I will take a little bit of that because we've been working through. But before I call on Mr. Nichols, let me just, to the point that you made, Jeff, about how would the public know that changes have been proposed. When I went to the RAC committee meeting last week, one of their suggestions was that we create an agenda notification list in the same, or, you know, changes to the board meeting, basically, so that people could get on a list and Lloyd's office could push out new materials have been posted, so that people wouldn't have to check all the time. They would be signing up and they would get something on their email that said the WMATA board has posted additional materials for the meeting. So I think there's some way we technologically can at least address a piece of what I think is a legitimate concern. Mr. Nichols.
The observation I would make in terms of the conversation is that I'm hoping that we get to a point where there is less frenetic activity required for our business, because I know I can only claim being new for a few more weeks, but I'm at this point still very new. And I think that, but the observation I think I've shared just in the collegial discussions we've had is that we need to get to a place that we are much more efficient, requiring much fewer meetings, but the meetings we have be of importance to not only the board activity, but also for community awareness, so that they don't get fake, I'll use the term fake loosely, meaning information that is not of sufficient importance that they even need to be bothered with it. And we're bothering with it because it is important, and I understand that right now. But over time, I think we should have to drive the staff less to prepare this kinds of minutia so that they don't have to have that pressure. And I know that my guess is that having sat in the staff position a lot of times is that a lot of the updated information is driven by our updated demands. and that they get data out. We have enhanced needs. They get new data out, and it's just an inevitable part of the cycle that we're in, and we've got to take charge of breaking that, and part of that is just the pain we're going through right now. But I think that's a lot of where we are, and I hope that our business will become more routinized over time. I think from an administrative standpoint, they're probably just as burdened as the people who are managing the infrastructure, you know, Kubitschek and all those folks. They're having the same burdens right now.
Mr. Pan.
I was just going to add that as a follow-up to what Mr. McKay said, I think the general manager and staff, we have tightened up our review of the items a lot. As you can see, for the next board meeting, you have more consent items instead of bringing things to the committee that really are not of sufficient importance to be discussed at a committee. So there are fewer items at the committee. We also, in the last month, if there is some item that has gone on a Friday and then it's discovered that there's a significant change, we have actually pulled the item instead of confusing the issue between the Friday and Thursday. So I think we are aware of that. It's just as much a problem for us. So we are kind of trying to streamline that and make the committee meetings agendas more productive for substantive items. So,
Mr. Giancola.
First of all, Mr. Nichols is now an old hand. He's no longer a young hand. I prefer getting all my correspondence electronically, but, you know, this is a dynamic organization. Things change daily. And so I don't have as big a problem with getting updates or changes as long as I get them. You know, I don't want to necessarily walk into a meeting and get them at that point. So having the electronic version updated would be the key for me. And most of the reading I do is over the weekend anyway, so I do really prefer to have it on Friday. And then I touch base, and I can touch base and update any thinking I have or review if it's been updated. But we need to know if it's updated. In other words, a little notice from the board secretary, someone saying, by the way, this section has been updated, would be helpful. Like, then I can go back and look at that.
But I don't think we should have the technology drive the process. If it's simple to update, we'll get lots of updates. I think we should really be clear. The rule is we don't expect to get the updates. We expect to get the product right. First, I also would point out that the committee chairs are important in this process as they clear the agenda, as they review the material, and we need to be sure that they do it. I speak for myself as well, early enough to be sure that it's a product that we're ready to have presented. I would also think, separate from the procedures, we might want to think more about the technology of how this material is provided. If I could read it better electronically, I would do that. But right now, I've got to print everything out to read it.
Well, actually, Ms. Hudgens, before she left, passed me a note saying we might want to mention someplace in our procedures that our expectation is that our electronic documents are provided in the format that people who have vision impairment can access too. So, you know, and I just don't know enough to know about that. But those kinds of issues actually did come up at the RAC as well. So I think we can probably take care of that. Mr. Barnes.
I'd like to just follow up on comments that others have made about trying to facilitate a more efficient process for the board and the staff. These procedures indicate that we meet twice a month. I really think that the work of this board can be done by meeting once a month, committees and board, if we are more efficient in looking at the kinds of actions that a board should be considering for an organization like this. This locks in or at least it says the committees normally meet second Thursday and fourth Thursday and whatnot. I really believe we can do our work unless there's something special that comes up that requires other meetings during a month. I really believe that a board of this type can function appropriately by meeting once a month with updates as necessary electronically or by paper or whatever processes between meetings. I hope that we can quickly move to that. The amount of staff time that goes into preparation for these meetings is huge. And this is a real burden on this organization from a governance standpoint. And I just very strongly believe that, that this board and committees, we should find a way to do this once a month so that all the preparations don't have to be done twice a month and all of the staff time of attending the meetings doesn't have to happen twice a month. This is overkill from a governance standpoint. I believe strongly, I think you're getting the point that I believe it strongly. Having been on the staff side in organizations as well as on board side, I know how much work goes into preparing all these materials and all the huge number of hours, and it really reduces the effectiveness of Metro for us to be meeting as much as we're meeting.
Mr. Costa.
I think the key to that is really agenda setting, and that to the extent that, and I think Mr. Pant raised the fact that the general manager, CEO, and chief of staff is actually trying to call out stuff on the agenda, but I think we need to be clear about what we expect to see on the delegated actions versus things that we want on the committee and stick to it. I think that's, they're having a conversation, but I don't think we're having the conversation with them in terms of saying, you know, this is the sort of things that we want to bring to the board versus things that you should just do on your own. And that's really the conversation if you want to get down to a very short meeting.
Mr. McKay.
One simple way in the bylaws to fix this is just that committees will meet as necessary.
Right.
I mean, I don't know. I agree with you. I mean, I think it's overly prescriptive and normally and, you know, then if for some reason there's not a need for a committee meeting, then that would be out of the ordinary. And instead, it'd rather be there's a need for a committee meeting, and it should be, I would think we should set these as that they will be meeting as needed, and then determine it based on the volume of material, based on how quickly we're able to get to a more streamlined agenda that was mentioned before. And I mean, going back to the earlier conversation about the quality of the material that goes out and not having to make changes to it later, I actually think if you met once a month that would help with that problem, because as the staff, if you know you've got to get your material in and you've got one shot this month, and if you don't get it in right, you're going to have to wait a whole nother month, it might actually improve the complete package of what we're getting to solve one of the earlier problems. Knowing that you can come back 2 weeks later is not probably too productive, and so my recommendation on this, based on what I've heard, and a lot of it I agree with, is that we should set these meetings as needed.
Mr. Down.
I certainly think meetings shouldn't occur for the sake of having meetings and could be scheduled more effectively. I don't want to see us give up the time we need for appropriate oversight.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the action takes time but doesn't produce anything. I think oversight is a much more important activity. And so we need to figure out how we can schedule our opportunities to do that.
I actually think, and we're now talking about 7B on page 7, where the committee meeting is kind of laid out, that whole, and I don't know, this is just, I think, the traditional groupings that have been around for a while, what meets when. And I certainly don't have an objection to saying, they'll meet as needed. I think, and we're all really busy people, and I really understand that. I also think you do have to have some held time for things that come up that are out of the ordinary. And so that's the other piece of how we think about doing our work going forward. And there may be years when something really does need to meet more often, or you cannot squeeze it all into that one day. So I think the language that you're suggesting is fine. I also think we probably need to put something in here that says there'll be a conversation in December of each year about what the likely schedule might be, which lets us make sure that we're holding appropriate time on our calendars. Because once I give that Thursday morning up, it will be gone. And I'm sure that's probably true for everybody sitting around here. And I know that staff can talk about the difficulty of trying to get us all together for orientation. And we don't want to be in a situation where, 3 months out of the year, staff is scrambling to find 2 hours when the board could, in fact, hold what a meeting which needs to be held. So
the I completely agree with that, and I'd like to really just speak to both the point that Mr. Downey made and also Mr. Barnes, and that is two things. One is we must become more efficient. As Michael was saying, we've got to become more efficient. We've got to operate like a board as opposed to a management committee, which I think we tend to delve in as a management process. And I think that to the point that Mr. Downey made, we need to get to the place where we are doing oversight as opposed to micromanagement. And I think that's the trap that we are in. And the I think the objective, at least my sense is, the objective should be to get to that level of efficiency. We can start by giving ourselves the flexibility, but I think we really have to have an intentional objective to get to that point, as opposed to giving it to simply just giving us the flexibility. And I think it's a good step to take. But I think efficiency and the predictability, and I think in fairness to the public, that really is a much better place for them to be, so that they don't have to guess how much of their calendars they have to keep available to make sure that we don't do things that have that make no sense. I mean, they really. We want to be as completely transparent as possible. It's very important. And I think the public deserves the benefit of knowing with some predictability what we're going to do and when we're going to do it. And I think getting to a point where we have less frequent meetings but more substantive meetings will actually be of substantial benefit to the public in terms of their engagement and ability to really provide us the kind of quality feedback that they deserve to be able to put into the system. And I think that more time doesn't necessarily result in better outcome.
Right. I do think we all of us who are new, though, we have to be mindful that we haven't been through the cycle yet.
I understand.
And
completely.
You know, it will feel, I have a couple of months on you. There are things that are now repeating because we're in the second quarter. So it's beginning to feel a little more familiar, but I do think we have to keep our mind on that as well.
And yes, Ms. One final point on that. We have to be disciplined as well. I can think of years when we've forced ourselves into a position where we've had to call all these special meetings and we meet every week for a short period of time to accomplish a budget. It's usually related to the budget. And we can't be having these special meetings, backing ourselves into emergencies where we have to do it. And we even did it this year. We had to have a special meeting. And to Mary's point, by the time we found out that Thursday of that special meeting, I had 14 things on my schedule already. And so, you know, we need to be conscious of what message we send to the public when we're doing that. But also, we need to be disciplined enough to get a schedule and to stick to it. And we shouldn't be calling special meetings frequently. Just because we backed ourselves into a corner where we couldn't accomplish what we needed to based on the agenda. So the board has to be a lot more disciplined with that, too.
Just one more point, and that's it's a great discussion, by the way. And that while the point of emphasis here has been on time, that really isn't the point of importance. Because my comments with respect to time, as much as I'm jealous of my own time, and I'm sure everyone else is as well, too, it really isn't the point of the discussion. It's what can we do to make our oversight role more effective? And time is a component of that because it drives everything else that happens here, time and efficiency. So the point of time strictly relates to that, is how can we support management staff? How can we meet our obligations from an oversight perspective to help continue the process that is well underway? And That's the substance of my point.
Okay.
Thank you.
Ms. Hutchins.
I'm sorry I wasn't good on the beginning of this discussion, but as I listened to the tail end of it, I think that you may be focusing on a specific item of the agenda, but I really of the procedures. Uh-huh. But I really think that the evaluation of what we do and how we do it is going to be the key to it. That is, how do we get work done? Mm-hmm. Are we meeting what we ascribed for the big beginning of the year to ensure that we get it done, and that way we look back and we reflect, because otherwise we'll constantly feel that we can do whatever we want because we don't have any standards, so we don't have any measurements, we don't have any criteria that we're going to say we're going to adhere to and be held accountable at some point in time to having done that. And I think that's going to be it's a new thing for us, but I think it's a good thing.
All right, so can I just take us back to page 5 and page 6? We've got these notes around B on page 7 now. B on page 5 is simply the order of the agenda. And then the record of the board and committee meetings, actually, so we spent a little bit of time talking through this with staff, trying to make sure that we were as clear as possible. I don't know if people have any issues they want to raise in Roman numeral 5 on page 6. I know Mr. Downey has something on Roman numeral 6, so I just want to make sure we're okay up to that. Ms. Hutchins?
I was out, and I just put a note as I read the change of the agenda on page 5. And was there a discussion regarding the public comment?
I'm going to turn to Ms. O'Keefe because this is one staff suggested.
What?
To move public comment.
To move public comment with, instead of out, before everything starts, to allow the public comment to be part of.
It really is purely up to the board. I mean, normally you would approve the agenda in the minutes as an opening item of the board, but there is no reason you couldn't have public comment right at the beginning.
If public comment's on the agenda, wouldn't you want to approve the agenda first and then have the public comment? I actually think the change here is a better one because it's a formal part of the agenda, then you would want to approve the agenda to allow for it.
That was the thinking.
And the minutes is generally just a matter of course activity.
Okay. I'm just used to being it, and so many others that do well that way. The item of the meeting is now forward, and we concentrate on that piece because I think it's very important that you separate it. So I know, just my comment. We can survive whichever process.
Lloyd, it just reminds me that actually we had strayed from our enabling resolution in our practice, and that this comports with the resolution board passed at some point in time about the order in which these things were to be done. Thank you, Lloyd. I've forgotten that. Yeah. So, if we were, question answered. Okay. All right. Anybody have any issues around the record of board and committee meetings being posted, all of that sort of stuff? This is very much what we do now. So, Mr. Downey, I'm going to turn to you on 6.
6, executive sessions. And this comment I raised at the last meeting. I wasn't here 2 years ago, 3 years ago, 4 years ago, but my understanding was there was concern that too much of the business of the authority was being put into executive sessions and the considerable loss of transparency. Last year, which is the only process I'm used to, the rules were very strict with respect to executive sessions. They were only board meetings. There was no provision for executive session of committee meetings. And I just think before we change back to what was an old process, we should stop and say, is that really what we want to do? If it's what we want to do, if it's done according to the rules, that if it's subjects only certain issues that in fact deserve executive session, I'm comfortable with that, but I'd hate to see all our business wind up happening upstairs.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think the public would be pretty much outraged if that were the case.
Ms.
Hutchins? I think you're correct, and I think at one point when the change was made, we also had an affirmation of why we were doing it, and we
that was read publicly.
We resolved coming out that we did that, and that is we take quite. It says we take quite clearly that what we're going to do is within the statute, and what we did was within the statute that we want to start here. Our guidelines. I think the question of whether or not there should be an opportunity to have an executive session of a committee could be a different part of that discussion. I think it is important that we acknowledge publicly over and over that we're not going to abuse this process, and that's what it should be.
you know, we've not added this, the sort of, what do we call that?
In there.
The affirmation afterwards. This doesn't appear in any of the documents that we currently use. The question about scheduling executive sessions in advance, the members of the public who've talked to me about this have said, you know, it would be really good if even you would just cite which one of the reasons that the committee is going into executive session that comes right out of the bylaws, so that you, it might say, you know, to handle real estate matters or investigations, or, you know, there are about 9 different reasons in the published agenda if people are going to schedule in advance. So we might want to add some more language around that identification. I thought, Mr. Downey, part of your concern was that committees could decide the day of the meeting with no notice. Yeah, to go upstairs. And I think if something comes up, you kind of do need the flexibility. If you can't, you know, something happens and you can't really talk in public and it meets the criteria, you want the flexibility of being able to do that in the meeting. But I think identifying the reason that ties back to the bylaws is actually quite important.
Actions are only taken by the board.
That's right. Yeah. And so committee can, they could come back out and say, we're going to recommend X to the board, I suppose.
And I think we should, you know, be mindful of the bylaw provision on communication with the public, which really speaks to transparency, speaks to broadest possible communication, speaks to broadcasting our meetings, and not reverse that and say, but all of the business will be done behind closed doors.
Right. Anyone else on this topic?
Yeah.
So Mr. McKay.
I like the sentence that's added about identifying what will be discussed in executive session. Kind of shocking that that's being added now, but I like that it's there, but I don't know that we've settled the reaffirmation piece, and if we are, should not this be where it is added?
Yeah, I agree.
If I could ask a procedural question here with respect to committees. As drafted, it says the chair could schedule an executive session in advance,
mm-hmm.
or it could be voted on the day of the meeting.
Right.
If the chair schedules in advance, that still will be an item on the agenda, and it would have to be adopted.
Right.
And if there's objection to having that, it can be raised at that time.
Right.
Yeah, and I might choose to raise it from time to time.
We had language at one point that we used as that affirmation, and I guess that would be something that we could insert in review.
Lloyd still has it. Okay, yeah. Good. We can share that with everybody. All right. So, Mr. Downey, does that, with that, you're comfortable? Okay. Anybody else? Ms. O'Keefe, I'm sorry.
Is that a direction to reinstate the post-executive session
yes.
confirmation that the items that were discussed?
Yes.
For both the board and the committee?
Yes. Moving on to Article 7, we've already talked about B. Any comments on A or C? Hearing none. We've removed D because we had that conversation in the bylaws, and so it's no longer applicable. 8 speaks to the public hearings, which just gives a little bit of permissiveness around who can actually be the hearing officer. And then 9 is this how to amend them. And Ms. O'Keefe, can you just remind us what consistent with Compact Section 8A means for those of us who don't know the Compact by heart?
Well, that's just invoking the board voting rules in the Compact so that in addition to a majority, the vote in favor of an action has to also include a vote from one member from each signatory, Maryland, Virginia, and the district. That was inserted to make clear that I think the language used to just say a majority, and that was perhaps a question that there was some intent to have a voting rule inconsistent with the Compact. So that's just a clarification.
the voting rules are the voting rules all the time that we vote. Mr. Barnes.
Let me go back to the committee question.
Which
again.
One are you looking
numbers,
at?
Numbers, Article 7, formation,
uh-huh.
Top of page 7. Each committee shall be chaired by a principal board member and shall be a committee of the whole. That's saying that every committee is 16 members, right?
Well, and let me just, this is the other thing I need to put on the table, is that the practice with procedures has been that they were updated annually to reflect however the board decided to organize itself. And so the committee of the whole decision was made for this year, given the number of new members that we had. When we get to December, whenever we have the conversation, I haven't been here all year, so I don't know. I think the board would have a conversation about when they adopt the procedures for 2012, how do they choose to organize themselves? So that is a place where it's kind of like insert your game plan. For
there's really no reason to have committees if all the committees have 16 members.
I think we all agree with you about that, but there is this learning curve we're on. So.
Okay.
Okay. Ms. Hutchins.
And I just wanted to affirm that part. I was working toward making sure we had a core board to make changes and do the business. And so the flexibility of being able to accommodate each new member that's come to the table and have their ability to participate on the volume of people that changed was really the point here. And I disagree with your point about making it a little bit more laborious in terms of everyone participating but not needing it. But I think it has served us to the point so that we can make that decision at the next board chair or by any item.
Right. And say, you know what, we have a game plan that thinks it'll work. We'll go back in and make the adjustment in the procedure.
That's
the
it.
Procedures have much more flexibility in them for ease of adjustment than the bylaws do. At least that's the construct.
Mr.
Down.
Yeah. On the subject of amendments to procedures and amendments to the bylaws, one of the reasons we discussed adopting bylaws, which did not exist before, was to give predictability and stability to where we are. As I read this, maybe I'm misreading it, but essentially what this is saying is, but at any given meeting, a board could amend the bylaws or amend the procedures, which in effect says, we'll waive the rules today and do business differently. I'm wondering if, in fact, those kinds of actions should be limited to something that is put on the agenda in advance, so it's not an unexpected change.
Sure. I think that makes some sense, and there's a way to adjust the sentence to say at a meeting where it's been advertised in advance, change to the bylaws would be considered. Or not the bylaws, the procedures, because this is only about the procedures. Mr. Wells.
Is that issue disposed of?
I was looking to see if people are, I think that's a good addition, actually, that somebody just can't bring it up and have cobbled their little group together and put the whole thing into an uproar. I think that's probably right.
Okay, I have a separate issue for
Sure. Suppose
that. I believe that regarding the jurisdictional veto that we stated that there has to be advance notice. Should there be anything, do you think, in procedures about how that notice is, anything around the notice requirement of how it's communicated?
Well, but you'd have to notice the chair in order to get it on the agenda. That's a good question. I don't have my bylaws with me today, so can you let us go back and
Sure. Take
a look at that?
Sure. Thank you.
It's a good question. All right. Anything else on procedures at this point? Are you all comfortable having these sort of be a draft that could be shared with the public at this point? Once we go through and make the adjustments that we talked about today, are you comfortable? Because for some people, being able to see the bylaws and the procedures together is a useful construct, particularly the around the public comment and participation issues. So if you're... Yeah. Okay, so we'll go ahead. We have a conference call scheduled for next week. We'll clean it up and share it with the letter. We did send, I think I told you all this, but we did send a letter to all of the stakeholder groups who had commented on board governance Monday. Lloyda, did it go Sunday or Monday? With links and everything. And in case you haven't seen it, it is up on the front page of the website that we're asking for comment. As part of a distribution or a rotation. Ms. O'Keefe.
Mrs. Hines, just a point of clarification on Mr. Wells' comment. He was asking about a procedure for limiting the under limiting jurisdictional veto, there's a process in the bylaws.
Right.
There's just a general comment that there'll be advance notice. Was
right.
there a...
He's asking, could we give an indication in the procedures how that would work. Who are you noticing? Are you noticing the chair?
Historically, it's happened in the committee meetings where a board member who has a specific deep-seated opposition to an action will simply tell everybody that if it goes forward to the board in the manner that it's currently framed, that particular member anticipates voting against it and also presumably speaking to the other signatory member to persuade that member to vote against it. Were you thinking of something more formal than that, Mr. Wells?
I know that this is a sensitive issue around governance recommendations, and it just seemed that that since we're asking for advance notice, that it seemed that possibly in the procedures area that we would give some definition of what's expected of advance notice, not to limit the right of jurisdictional veto or anything like that as much as to incorporate it in our board process so that it is, it's predictable and functional.
The procedures could encourage members to provide that advance notice at the appropriate committee meeting if it comes up at a committee. Of course, if it doesn't, then, and I'm sensing there'll be fewer committee items, then it's, we still have the issue of how to notice on a matter that goes directly to the board. For example, as a consent item,
right,
or just an administrative item.
And I certainly understand there's customary practice, but it just seemed like that had been an issue of concern from outside groups that are concerned about our process.
I think you could write it in such a way that you would say whenever possible.
Mm-hmm.
Notice should be given to the chair, either of the committee or of the board, that a member is strongly considering the jurisdictional veto or you know, some language like that. I mean, sometimes you do learn things in a meeting that you're just like, well, it's over, right? It doesn't happen real often, but I bet we've all been in meetings where that decision has happened for us. But I think... If something's coming and you already know you feel strongly enough that you think you might say this at a board meeting, you might as well call the chairman, you know, and say, hey, you know, this is on a path I'm really having trouble with. Because maybe that's how we get to resolution in a more orderly manner. So, does that make sense to people? Yeah? Okay.
So we'll try to craft something.
Yeah. All right. Okay, well, we'll go ahead and get these out to people next week. And then I did want to turn our attention here in the last little while that we have to the code of, it's been called the Standards of Conduct. We are proposing we change it to the Code of Ethics because conduct, people were like, well, are you riding the train enough and do you go to enough meetings? And conduct got into a lot of other behaviors. So we're suggesting a change in the Code of Ethics, to the Code of Ethics. most of us have read this already and signed it. I mean, we all have actually read it already and signed it once, at least, sorry. So the only section that we have spent time in preparation for the meeting on, and you did get a memo from the IG, is this very last section, Article 8 on page 6, which has to do with what should happen if there's an allegation against one of us or against the IG. Although this is at, well, so you've read the memo, I hope, and I'm interested in what others have to say about this. Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Yes, it's okay.
Once this discussion concludes, I'd like, if I may, to take a few moments to go over what I consider the heart of the standards of conduct. I haven't quite changed it in my mind. And so what I'm asking the Board Secretary to hand out is just a one-page summary of the conflict of interest provisions. It can be, I think, a little confusing to try to thread through the various ways that the board in the past has chosen to implement the compact conflict of interest position. So it's not proposing a change. It's okay. Just it might be useful to have a little review of how all that fits together.
Okay. Mr. Donner?
Yeah, I had a question on that, and in fact,
maybe it would be best to let you do that, and that puts this into a context then. Why don't you go ahead, Ms. Yeah. O'Keefe, and then we'll...
I'll ask my question afterwards.
Yes, great, Mr. Donner.
So, does everybody have this little one here? Starting over on the left under compact, and this is only addressing the explicit conflict of interest provision. There is a, what I'll call an anti-bribery section, but that's not what we're talking about now. The compact is fairly simple and straightforward. It provides that board members shall not be financially interested directly or indirectly in any contract, sale, purchase, lease, or transfer of real or personal property to which the board or the authority is a party. So the compact is quite absolute, and it clearly prohibits any financial interest, but the prohibition is against the transaction that is coming before the board. The standards of conduct flesh this, let me step back. On a violation of the standards of conduct, which you'll get to later, the board is the sole judge, and the penalties for a violation, should the board determine that there has been a violation, are either expulsion of a board member or voiding of a contract or other transaction. Those are the very hard-edged provisions of the compact. So, in any legal framework, there are always questions about virtually what every operative provision means. So the standards of conduct of the Code of Ethics then, and that's in the center column, adopt several provisions that are guidance to board members as to what the compact means. So the first thing is, it goes a little bit further in terms of interest in a matter before the board. So the prohibition is not only against a board member, but against a board member's household member. And that term, on the final column on that page, contains all the definitions. So you can see what household member means. And as you would expect, it's a member of your household and largely it's an immediate family concept, or somebody else who resides in your household who's a dependent. And that That definition is fairly consistent with the definitions in the three signatories. And in fact, the standards of conduct were largely an amalgam of the three different signatory conflict of interest provisions. And that particular definition is reasonably consistent with the analog in the other, in the signatory laws. So there's an absolute prohibition on financial interest. So then, then you get to the part that's a little tricky. Financial, direct financial interest is defined over on the far right-hand side. And that's really an ownership interest in that, let's say, transaction. And there's a 3% on direct ownership, and then there's a definition of indirect financial interest, which would largely arise if, for example, a board member had a firm that provided subcontracting services of any type. And that focuses on the income that's derived from that relationship. So there's also a 3%, and that 3% of the director's partnership, et cetera, is focused on revenues of the current or preceding fiscal year. So if a board member had, let's say, a consulting firm that provided its services to a contractor before the board, then that is applied. Now, I will note on that indirect financial interest, I noticed, because I was taking a look at the signatory conflict of interest statutes, those tend to use more of a finite number as opposed to a percentage on the indirect interest. On the direct, it's typically a percentage that's used. 3% is in line with what the signatories use. So the second part is, apart from ownership or financial interest in a particular matter before the board, and again, it's not only the board member's interest, but a household member. Then we go down to the second tier. There's a prohibition on voting on a transaction if either the board member, household member, or business member's associate has a financial interest, and the term that the Standards of Conduct or Ethics Code uses is enterprise. And that could probably use some clarification, but the concept is that the business entity that is contracting with the authority. So in this instance, it isn't necessary for the board member to have an interest in the matter that is specifically before the board, whether it's a contract or a real estate transaction. If a board member has, or their business associate or household member has an interest in that entity, an ownership interest, and of course we're still using the direct and indirect matter. So in that instance, you're simply advised not to vote, to recuse yourself. It's not a prohibited interest, but you are enjoined from voting. So again, the
would that not obligate the board member also to do a disclosure as and not participate, or is just be not participate? Would you not? I mean, they go hand in hand, do they not?
Well, in the event, you mean at the moment? it's not required that you disclose your specific. It's simply required that the board member recuse himself. But in any event, the board member is not participating or voting, so it.
Yeah, a question here, and it's a couple of small words, but I think they're very important. There is a difference between what you have on this piece of paper and what is currently in the Code of Ethics. I think it's a very significant difference.
Which one?
Let's take the, it's true with both, but let's talk about the employment. What currently is here says a board member shall neither vote on nor participate in any financial transaction if the board member is employed by a party with a business relationship. The explanation here, which I think is more accurate, says in any transaction in which the board member has a relationship.
Right. This is.
I think the in which is very important. I mean, just speaking of myself, I have a disclosed relationship with a number of entities who may be doing business with the authority. I do no business for the authority, but I have a relationship with them. The way I would read the current code, I can't vote on anything because I have that relationship. What I've been doing is following what I think was the advice. I don't vote on anything having to do with an entity in which I have a relationship.
Relationship?
Employment relationship.
Well, we get to that.
Yeah.
That's the third. I mean, there's an employment prohibition,
yeah,
too.
Right.
But
that's the employment is one I'm talking about, but the in which would at least resolve it for me.
Well, you're right. This guide is a slight paraphrase in a couple instances,
yes,
just for
I
ease.
I think the paraphrase
of,
is important.
Right.
It should be in the code.
Well, the exact language in the standards of conduct is on terms of the employment, which is the third restriction. A board member shall neither vote on nor participate in any WMATA financial transaction.
In any transaction if he or she is employed by a party.
Right. If
it doesn't
the board
say
member,
a specific transaction with respect to that party. It says any transaction.
Correct. Any transaction if the board member or household
if.
Member is employed
right.
by the
but
party.
I can read the if to mean in which. I can understand it, but it doesn't say in which. It says if.
Well, there are several definitions that in reading it again, I and my staff believe we could clarify things a bit because it's been some years since the board has taken up the standards of conduct. The clarifications that we're thinking of are not substantive changes. They're just clarifications. So we would like to offer those clarifications. But right now, we're just the little bit of paraphrasing that is in this sheet was not intended to really represent a change. It's just trying to outline how these sections and definitions fit together. Right, so the last prohibition has strictly relates to employment. So either the board's employment or a household member. They're employed by a party that has an actual matter before the board, then that's also a prohibition as in voting. Obviously, it's not a prohibited relationship. You just can't vote on it. So, yes, so and the reason I'm kind of belaboring this, and I apologize if it is a belaboring, but there are some absolutes in the compact. And those are absolute prohibitions. It isn't that you just can't vote on it. It is a prohibition as to the interest. The standards of conduct or the ethics then define, in terms of a percentage interest or percentage income, but it's still an absolute prohibition. So you have to choose as a board member whether you're going to have a 5% direct interest in an entity that comes before the board, or whether you're going to be a board member. Recusal is not a satisfactory response in that instance. On a party that comes before the board with a transaction, you may have an interest either direct or indirect, but not in that transaction, not in whatever is coming before the board. Like we have large consultants that work for the organization, and a board member or a board member's household member may have some relationship, either employment or ownership or indirect, but not in the matter that comes before the board. And that is simply a recusal issue. So I do think a couple of the definitions would benefit from clarification when I sat down and went through these again. And if we're not proposing it today, but I'd like the opportunity to come back with a few clarifying, which, again, is not changing the substance. That would be up to the board to direct us to do that, simply changing, for example, as Mr. Downey has suggested, changing the language so that it is perfectly clear. And that's really all I wanted to go through, because that's the heart of the conflict of interest. I think pretty much everything else is relatively straightforward. And maybe this is too, but for some reason for me, I always have to thread my way through it. So I'm hoping this will be helpful to you.
And so to kind of go, Mr. Wells.
Just quickly, I'm not trying to be politically correct, but to be inclusive, where we describe household and we say spouse or dependent, is there any reason why we, or can spouse be broadly defined, or do we need to have anything like domestic partner in that? Does it matter in the definition of household?
It's certainly a helpful clarification.
Okay.
All right. So, Mr. Dunn.
I had a further question on the applicability of the code. As stated,
you're on section calls, one.
Hmm?
Section one.
Section one. It governs the conduct of members of the board. Then it goes on to say it applies to all individuals, corporations, other entities that have business with the board. Is that second sentence really enforceable, and how might it be enforced? It's good guidance to people who are doing business with it. Don't pay off the directors, but is it really enforceable to say we have a code of conduct for the world?
I think the intent was just to provide notification that
we have
to the world that right. If there are violations, it could affect their interests, for example, you know, the potential voiding of contracts and so forth. But you're right, there's no way we can reach out and the board can reach out and do anything other than what is before it, which is the board members' conduct themselves or a particular financial transaction.
Okay, so to circle back to where we started, the issue before us is, should there be an allegation that one or another of us have violated these standards of conduct, how should the board handle that allegation? And as I said, we all got a memo from Ms. Liu earlier this week, sort of walking through some of the issues from her point of view. I did have the occasion to talk with my colleague who used to sit in this seat, who felt very strongly that you shouldn't put the IG in the position of having to investigate board members. And I tend to agree with that position myself. So we tried to craft a procedure or a process here in Article 8, at least for some discussion about how you would handle it. So comments are welcome.
Well, I think it is important we have a procedure.
Yeah.
I mean, certainly we cannot rely on self-reporting.
No, and you know, if it actually involves something illegal, I'm not sure it even ought to be at the board. I think it probably ought to go pretty directly to law enforcement. That's, again, just my gut on that, but I don't know how others feel. Yeah.
I guess the clarity, prescriptive clarity, I think is what's most important, in that it shouldn't be ambiguous. It should have intent. Everyone should understand it clearly. And obviously everyone wants to understand it clearly, because no one wants to jeopardize their personal interest or the corporate interest here. So I think that's the intent. And you know, for my part, I guess to understand where we want to go, we want to get to a point where everybody fully understands it, fully embraces it, and the public is fully aware. I guess the next step for us would be to take this to the next stage where we get the enhanced definitions, which I think are extremely important, because even this dialogue today, and I reviewed this with a fine-tooth comb myself, and you wake up at night, oh, did I remember this, did I remember that, or, you know, you want to make sure that you are have no discomfort with what happens at all and don't jeopardize the risk, even accidentally. You know, you realize a month later that something that you should have disclosed is occurring. So this is very helpful in that regard, and I think that we'll get the enhanced definitions, and then we'll have another discussion, and then we'll go forward. What's the projected schedule?
Well, that's a great question, Mr. Nichols. And let me just also, Carol, I think we did decide that you were going to reach out to the appropriate people and the signatories who are the keepers of the codes of conduct or the ethics codes, right? Didn't we decide that?
Yes.
Since everybody's law has moved along, it would be a good check-in again to have them county attorneys or city attorney or whoever take a look at it. So we're going to do that. So we actually have a committee meeting scheduled for 2 weeks from now on May the 23rd or 26th, whatever the date is, of our regular meeting. And I have invited the governance working group, which is the mayor and the governor's group that's looking at governance, as well as the leadership from the Board of Trade COG group to join us. And I did get confirmation that the Board of Trade and COG folks are planning to come. I don't know how many, so we'll find that out, as well as the folks who represent the governors and the mayor. So that will be our committee meeting, and we've asked them to come to have a conversation about the draft bylaws, okay? And I've already had some great conversation with some of these guys about how things that aren't in our control, we're not going to talk about them. We're going to focus on what was in our control in the bylaws. They have some suggestions, mostly, I think, for sharpening language and clarifying some things they find confusing. So we will spend an hour and a half doing that as our committee meeting on the 23rd, which means the code of conduct would come back June 9th with all those adjustments and having had the conversation with the other attorneys. Again, heading right now for adoption June 23rd of all of it. If we're not ready, if we get information, the GAO may have information that begins to float around the end of this month as well. So we're kind of trying to keep all those balls in the air so we can bring it to conclusion in a timely manner. So that's the game, that's the current game plan, which I hope is all right with everyone. We will get an agenda. I'm having a conference call on the 19th of May for that meeting on the 26th. So that will, hopefully we'll be able to kind of give you some targeted questions that we've all agreed are going to be where we put our conversation and stuff ahead of time. Hopefully for the Friday packet, but if not for Monday. So is that everybody comfortable? We're at our hour and a little past. So unless anybody has something that they wish to say in detail about the code of conduct or code of ethics or whatever we're going to end up calling it, we'll put this aside until we come back June 9th. Okay? All right. Thank you very much.